Our first speaker today, and our primary speaker, is Tom McFarland. Tom received his bachelor's degree at Stanford in 1988 in physics. He is presently in the graduate program in mathematics at the University of Washington. Our second speaker is Bob Briggs, and he is from Phoenix, and he received his degree in electrical engineering at the University of Arizona. He's had a long interest in Franklin's philosophy and particularly mathematics, as a certain understanding was induced through Dr. Wolf personally. Ron Leonard received his bachelor's degree in mathematics and his master's degree in philosophy at the University of Alberta. He recently received his doctorate from the University of Waterloo.
And contribute something to convention. I was here once before, and right after I first learned about Dr. Wolf, and it was a really special time for me when lots of things were opening up in my life, and I was learning lots of new things. And before I start, I'd like to acknowledge my great debt to Dr. Wolf, that he really opened things up for me reading his books. And also the people that he has influenced, since I wasn't able to meet him in person. I first came here after he died. But I've been able to learn from him through other people, Joel in particular. And he and I have discussed a lot of the ideas that I'll be talking about today. And although I wouldn't want to hold him at all responsible for anything I'm going to say, I gained a lot from those discussions, and I feel that a lot of it's due to him and his insights. And a lot of it also will come from a book called Laws of Form, written by George Spencer Brown, who's a mathematician. And that book's been a big influence on me and will influence this talk. And so those are the primary acknowledgments I'd like to make before I begin. As Dorothy said, Dr. Wolf saw mathematics as a kind of yoga indigenous to the West, a particular form of or path that might be expressed or suited for the Western psyche. And I think he described it in Pathways as a thread to the beyond that's never been lost. And I think it's something, for me anyway, that's very important to develop, not only as a personal path for an individual to explore who has this kind of temperament, but also because mathematics is so important in science and its symbols have lots of power due to their abstraction that I think can help reorient our whole worldview and reintegrate a more technological society with a spiritual society and hopefully bring those things closer together. I'm going to start out talking about a kind of idea that I think will link together religious ideas and scientific ideas, and a mathematics that can work with these symbols, that can cross over these disciplines. And that's the idea of distinction, making a distinction. It's a very primitive symbol, an act, an idea. I'm going to begin talking about why I think it serves as a connection between these two areas, and then I'll talk a little bit about the mathematics of distinction itself, what Spencer Brown developed, and some ideas I have about what he's done, and And then finally, I'll show how this mathematics, how this symbolism can be applied to scientific ideas and religious ideas, such as Dr. Wolf's, and integrate these into some sort of coherent picture. And before I dive in, I'd just like to mention that I think it was that John made a really good point this morning about how there are lots of other aspects of ourselves other than the intellectual. And although I think this is a very important avenue of spirituality, for most of us it isn't the whole story. And so I think that was a really important point to make, because it can be forgotten. An intellect without a heart can be a very dangerous thing. So, this idea of distinction is, I think, not difficult to find in the religious traditions. Dr. Wolf, I know, in his description of his mystical unfolding in the philosophy, said that one of the key points that he realized early along the way was that the primary difference between transcendent consciousness and our ordinary consciousness is that transcendent consciousness is a state in which the disjunction between the subject of consciousness and the object of consciousness is destroyed. So right here we have the idea of distinction as being a fundamental demarcation point between ordinary and transcendent consciousness. And he also mentions that the principle of contradiction simply had no relevancy in the transcendent state. And this, I think, indicates what lots of mystics have said over and over in lots of different ways the world over, is that the one has no distinction whatsoever, or it transcends distinction. And so I think the whole mystical path is centered around this idea of the distinctions, of the apparent differences that we have in this world, and being able to see beyond them, being able to transcend them. And so it starts with this idea of distinctions and working with that, trying to get beyond it. Now, in science and mathematics, in a lot of ways, I think they've tried to run away from this distinction. In physics, for example, the whole materialistic paradigm, the view that reality consists of objects out there, independent of any subject or spirit, that the ultimate reality is simply objective. And this worked well enough with a simple kind of science. But recently, in the 20th century, quantum mechanics came along and sort of threw a monkey wrench into this prejudice that was superimposed upon the scientific method. And undermined this idea that reality could be simply objective, that the objective was independent of a transcendent subject. And this is really demonstrated probably most clearly in what's called the measurement problem of quantum mechanics. Just to give you a flavor of what this is, I'd like to briefly describe to you a little bit about quantum mechanics and what this measurement problem is. And the problem is based on the idea that there is just an objective reality without dependence on the subject, and that's why it runs into problems. The quantum mechanical description of the world involves what's called a wave function that is a mathematical entity which describes a particular system that you choose to study. So for example, if I consider an object such as an atom and I wish to isolate this for study, then it has a wave function associated with it. And the interesting thing about this wave function that makes quantum mechanics different from all other science preceding it is that the wave function describes the reality in terms of probabilities. And it's not simply a matter of our lack of knowledge of what's happening. If I roll some die and toss them behind a wall and ask you, well, what's behind the wall? You'll think, well, the dice have actually fallen in a particular way, and it's just a matter of determining which way they actually have already fallen. In quantum mechanics, the situation is different. Until you've actually observed, you cannot say that it exists in a particular state. So, for example, in the atom, the electrons orbit in these energy levels. And until you actually observe the electron in one level or the other, you can't say that it necessarily exists in one state or the other when you're not looking at it. It's only when you actually observe the electron that you're allowed to say this. The reasons for this are a little subtle, and I could go into it afterwards with anyone. But this difference is really important, and that it's not simply a matter of not knowing what's going on while you're not looking. It's a question of you're seeing it actually somehow influencing what actually comes to be. And when you're not looking at it, it's a mere potential for something to happen. And so already we have this hint of a dependence of the object on the subject. Erwin Schrödinger, who was a physicist who invented or helped invent lots of quantum mechanics, came up with an interesting sort of thought experiment that involves a cat. He takes a box and he puts a radioactive atom in it and a little detector that can detect when the atom decays. And when the atom decays, it triggers a little switch that drops a hammer and breaks a poison bottle that kills the cat. They didn't actually do this experiment, but it's conceivable. Now, when you put the cat in this box and close the box all off, if you haven't looked inside, there's, say, a 50-50 chance that after an hour, the atom has decayed. Now, according to quantum mechanics, in this description with the wave function, you cannot say that the cat is alive or dead at any given moment. In a sense, it only exists as a potential for one or the other. And of course, when you open it, you'll see the cat one way or the other. And this disturbs lots of people, because we have this idea that the objects exist in and of themselves independently of any subject to observe them. And that's the myth of objective existence. Now, things can get a little more complicated if you put another box around this and, say, put your friend inside that box with the box with the cat in it. So now you have two boxes. The cat's in the first one, your friend's in the second one, and you seal them all off, and you're outside of it, Now, according to your description, even if your friend looks at the cat, your friend will now be in this potential state, the superposition of states, they call it, of having seen a dead cat and having seen a live cat. And his sort of objective reality relative to you will not exist until you open the second box and ask your friend, well, which way did you see the cat? And you can keep putting these boxes around things sort of forever. And you can actually take it as far back as your own brain. You can say, well, if you try to objectify your own physical existence and consider that as part of the system that you're considering, then even your brain, your own brain, you could consider as existing in these two states. And then the question is, well, why is it that I look out at the world and I see a definite something out here? How is it that there isn't just this potential everywhere? My brain should be in these all these different potential states, and if everything is simply objective matter, there's nothing to observe them. There's nothing to create an actualized world. And so quantum mechanics runs into this big problem of not being able to account for the fact that the world really exists at all without really introducing some idea of a subject that's transcendent to all the objects that it's possible to observe. And so this attempt to run away from the distinction between subject and object, to forget about the subjective side and consider everything as objects, just completely fails with quantum mechanics. And this, I think, is a big hint from on the science side that this distinction is something very important and something very fundamental in science, that all observation is dependent on this distinction, and that everything, every object that arises due to this distinction that's created between subject and object. We also find a similar sort of thing in mathematics. There was an attempt early in the century, again, to describe mathematical truth as some sort of objective truth. I wanted to systematize all of mathematics into a bunch of axioms, so that if you asked any question at all in mathematics, you could conceivably derive it from the axioms, like Euclid's geometry or something. And so this scheme is sort of analogous to the idea in science of making an objective reality. Only in mathematics it was more of an objective truth that they were trying to nail down. And a fellow by the name of Gödel proved a theorem that threw a monkey wrench into all this. And what he did is he did something along these lines. He said, well, consider if you had a computer that was programmed with all these axioms, then supposedly, if you ask it any mathematical question, it can churn away and give you the answer. You know, yes, it's true, no, it's not true. And if mathematical truth can in fact be objectified into these axioms, then it will be able to answer every question that you can ask it. But then Gödel comes along and he asks the computer the following question. Let's call this computer the consistent truth machine. And incidentally, the assumption that it's consistent is very important here, that it doesn't contradict itself, because what good would it be then? So he writes down the following sentence. He says, the consistent truth machine will not say that this sentence is true. Then he gives it to the computer, and the computer starts turning away. Now let's think about what will happen here. Let's say the computer answers, yes, it's true. Well, the sentence was, the consistent truth machine will not say that this sentence is true. And so if the computer says that it's true, well, it's just contradicted what the sentence asserts. And so the sentence is, in fact, false. And so the truth machine contradicts itself if it answers true. Okay, now let's see what happens if it answers false. So the computer says false. Okay. Now the sentence was, the consistent truth machine will not say that this sentence is true. Well, it didn't. It said it was false. And so the sentence is in fact true. That's a good idea. Okay, our sentence is, I won't write out consistent truth machine, I'll just write CTM. It will not say that this sentence is true. Okay, now, if it says that this is true, if it answers true, then it's claiming that the sentence is true. But the sentence says that it will not say that the sentence is true. And so we have a contradiction. Now, if it says that the sentence is false, well, the sentence says that it will not say that the sentence is true. Do you see how we get a contradiction? So the sentence is in fact true if it says that it's false. Because if it says that it's false, well, it will not say that the sentence is true. Okay. And so we run into a problem on that end, too. And so, if the machine is consistent, which we know that it is, it can't say that it's true, and it can't say that it's false. Now, what's interesting here is that because we know that this machine is consistent, we know, we've just gone through it, that the machine can't answer either way. It can't say it's true and it can't say it's false. And so, as a matter of fact, this sentence is true. But it can't say that it's true. But the computer can't know this. Only we can know this. And so, this is like being a step outside of our system when we're observing. If we've objectified our set of axioms, we can know something that internally it can never determine or decide. There's this incompleteness in the description of truth. If you objectify it, try and pin it down to objects, you can never grab onto the whole thing. And so this happens in mathematics as well, that you could conceivably program another computer, just like creating the second box around the cat, and you could program the computer to know that this computer is consistent, but then there's going to be another question for that computer that you can ask it. And you keep going on this chain until finally there's no objective way to completely grasp truth and pin it down into a bunch of axioms or anything. It simply can't be done. And so I think this is very analogous to the situation in quantum mechanics where we're observing things and we're trying trying to account for the reality of things objectively, and we run into this same problem that we can't quite nail it down if we're going to exclusively constrict reality or truth to objects. So I think this all hints at a common thread or a bridge between mysticism and science and mathematics, that there's this central idea of making a distinction that's sort of the, you might say it's where science and math ends and mysticism begins. And whereas traditionally science and math sort of tried to shove it under the table, mysticism embraces it and tries to transcend it. But in any case, it's there, and it's at the border between them. And if there's any way to symbolically link these, I think one of the most promising ways is to start with this fundamental connection between them, which is the idea of distinction. And that if we can formulate a mathematics of distinction, perhaps we can come up with a symbolic way of representing both in one comprehensive scheme, so to speak. So that's the first part of the talk. Now, the George Spencer Brown wrote a book called Laws of Form, where he developed just this. It's a mathematics of distinctions. And what I'd like to do is run through the principal ideas of this and give you a flavor of what it involves, and then go back over it and I guess try and shed some light on maybe what it means, what I think it might mean. And then go on to relate it to science and mystical thought. He starts out the book with this idea of making a distinction, sort of this primitive act, primitive notion. But before he actually says that, there's a page in the book right before he begins that's a bunch of Chinese characters, and I discovered that it was, I'm pretty sure it's a quote from the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu. And I think it's a part, if anyone knows different, I'd like to know. I think it's a part where, it's a part of the end of chapter one, where it says that the union of opposites, the truth that's hidden behind the yin and the yang, the two opposites, is a key to the mystery of all mysteries. And so there's this hint in the beginning of his book of something beyond or prior to the actual distinction. And we'll come to that, back to this after I run through what he has to say. He defines distinction as perfect continence. That is, that if you draw a circle, if you're on one side, you can't get to the other side without crossing the distinction. It's a really simple idea, very primitive. And he takes this idea as given. This is where he begins. And then he develops two axioms. One is called the law of calling, and the other is called the law of crossing. And there's sort of two aspects of making a distinction. If I make a mark on this board, I'm creating an object. I'm calling that object into existence by making this mark. And this is being created out of the idea of distinction, that here's an object and it's distinct from what is not the object. And the law of calling says that if I distinguish an object and distinguish it again, that that's just the same as just distinguishing the object. If I'm calling my cat, I say, you know, Frisker, Frisker. You know, it's the same as just saying Frisker. You know, it's just, I'm just calling. It's just real simple. This is one aspect of making a distinction. There's a sense in which you're just calling. You're repeating this creation of a distinction, this activity. The second law, the law of crossing, allows you to, in a sense, maintain this distinction and come back. It's like a departure and a return. And he symbolizes this as making a distinction and then crossing back over that distinction to where you began. So, if I make this mark and then use another mark, not in this sense as being a repetition of the same thing, but in another sense of sort of reacting back upon that or reversing it, then I return to what was before the first distinction. And so if, for example, if I draw a line on the ground, the first distinction tells me to cross the line. The second distinction tells me to cross back. I've returned. This is one way of thinking about what's happening here. Whereas this just tells me to cross, and then cross again, and then cross, and sort of just keep, I don't know, if you have balls, throwing them across the line, whereas one would be throwing them and pulling them back. It's this this involves a departure and a return, and this is just a departure. After this, he develops the idea of forming an expression out of all sorts of these marks. Using these two primitive axioms, he then considers arbitrary expressions say this, and according to the law of calling, the two marks reduce to one here, and so I can simplify this to these two nested marks, which is this, and I can simplify that to the blank board. And so this more complicated expression simplifies down to the blank board. On the other hand, if I had another mark out here, this part would have simplified, but this other mark would have remained. And this expression would have simplified to the marked state. And so you can form very, very complicated expressions with these simple marks of distinctions. And all of them will reduce down to one or the other of these two states. Now, he then jumps to the idea of an algebra, which involves variables. And so just like when we have x in our algebra and it can represent, say, any number, you know, 1 to a million or something, his variables represent one of these two states. So if I were to write x on the board, in Spencer Brown's algebra, this x would stand for either a mark or the absence of a mark. And then he allows himself to write equations using variables. And he finally comes up with a very interesting equation. Which equates this variable with the variable with a mark over it. Now, before I dive into this, let's try something a little more simple. Let's just say we have our x, and I've crossed it twice. Now, whatever this x is, whether it's a mark or the absence of a mark, these two will cancel each other. And so I can simplify this expression down to just x. And I have x equals x. And this equation is satisfied by either one of the two values. So if I were to plug in the unmarked state as x, I would get the unmarked state is equal to this, which is just the law of crossing. And so that's perfectly fine. On the other hand, if I substituted a mark for the x, I would have the mark is equal to 3 marks. Two of these would cancel, and I'd have the mark equals the mark. And that's perfectly consistent. Now this equation here is another matter. If I substitute a mark in here for f, I'll get a mark is equal to 2 marks, one nested in the other, and this cancels to the unmarked state. And so I have the mark equals the unmarked, which doesn't make a lot of sense if our distinction is in fact continent. Because this is saying we get from one side to the other without crossing. Why did I put a mark for f instead of the absence of a mark? Why did I put 2 here? 1 is for the f, because I was substituting a mark for f. So 1 is for the f, and the other is for this one that's explicit here. So the f is this one in here. And the second one corresponds to the cross over the f. And so I have, if f equals the mark, then substituting the mark wherever I see an f, I get a mark here for this f, and I get a mark here for that f, plus a cross over it. And I get this contradiction. On the other hand, if I substitute nothing for the f, then I'm getting nothing equals the cross, which is the same problem again. And so there's this contradiction either way. And so this equation doesn't have a solution in terms of the dualistic idea that every variable is either the marked or the unmarked state. It doesn't have a solution in terms of opposites, in terms of states that are actually distinct. And Spencer Brown says that you can think of there being a solution to this equation, but it's not one of these two states, either the marked or unmarked. It's an imaginary state. And he sort of ends the book there. And to me, this is a very intriguing suggestion, and I think what it indicates to me anyway is that there's a hint here that the distinction is not actually real. That writing this is, in a sense, asking us to reconsider the first distinction that we made. And ask ourselves whether it is a real distinction or whether perhaps we only imagined it. So let's go back to the beginning again and think about what's happening here. We start with a void. And there's no distinction at all. In the void. And you can think of this as consciousness without an object. Now, if we haven't distinguished anything, we can't distinguish objects from the absence of objects. There's not even that distinction. And so, if I make a mark, and we're speaking on the level of the void, making a mark is the same as not having made a mark at all. And I think Dr. Wolf said somewhere that it is that which is invariant to the presence or absence of objects. It doesn't matter if there's an object or not, that these two at that level are perfectly equivalent. And then, but in a certain sense, we have a name here, a mark, that is imagined to be distinct from the absence. Although in reality they're equal, here we've represented them as distinct. And this is a kind of self-reference, that on the one hand, this mark is the void. On the other hand, it's a part. It's a name for the void. It's standing for the void. And so at this very fundamental level, there's a kind of circularity. It's not a contradiction because there's no distinction to contradict. But there's a kind of self-reference. And one way of symbolizing this is to use this mark and say, well, the outside is re-entered into the inside. I'm just drawing this arrow around the distinction. You can see that very well. Now, if we choose to do so, we can imagine that this mark, that this distinction, is distinct from the void. We can break this reentry, and we can say that objects are distinct from the absence of objects. That the universe is different from nirvana. And once we do that, we develop this calculus of duality that Spencer Brown has, in which we have the law of calling and the law of crossing. And let me just sort of indicate maybe how we can understand these two laws out of this idea of breaking the reentry. In the original self-referential void, where the mark is equal to the unmarked state, it doesn't matter if I make several marks, or if I just make one mark, or if I don't make any marks at all. It's all equivalent. And so, remember the law of calling is that two marks are equal to one mark. Well, once I distinguish the single mark from the void, from the unmarked state, then the mark is distinct from the unmarked, but we still have the equivalence of two marks equals the one mark. And so this law of calling can be thought of as a sort of residue of this idea of that it doesn't make any difference to call the void and call it again and call it again, because it is the void, and there's no distinction here between these two, because ultimately they were the void, and the void is equal to itself. Now, once we've distinguished the mark from the absence of the mark, if we want a way to represent absence of a mark again with marks. We can take two marks with regard to each other in the second way, where one is nested within the other. And we can equate this to the void, to the absence of marks. And so this is a kind of reentry. On the one hand, we depart from the void. These are now fixed as objects distinct from the absence of objects. And now we have a way of representing a return to objectlessness with objects. And so this would be a symbolic way of saying the absence of objects. This cross means I want you to cross back away from the object. You've crossed into the object. Now return, go back. And that returns you to the absence of objects.
The void, neither the absence of object nor the presence of object, once you define it as the absence of project, haven't you then called it?
The level that we're dealing with right now is after we've, in a sense, fixed that distinction. We've imagined that objects...
You've already called it.
Mm-hmm. When we imagine that objects are distinct from the void...
So you are saying the void is not. It's not a neti-neti. It's the void is not, object is. It's not, the void is and isn't.
I'm not sure I follow.
To a polarity, literally.
Right, yeah. And so, yeah, we are in duality now here. And this return can be thought as sort of an image of this original return up here, where the mark wasn't distinguished from the absence of a mark. Here, we're using two marks to be indistinguishable from the absence of marks. And so this is kind of a second order return. And we can continue this pattern of breaking the reentry. And I can, just as I distinguished the mark from the void in the previous stage, I can distinguish these two marks here and say, well, these aren't really the void either. And then I fall into a three-level calculus, in which I have these two values, one mark and two nested marks, as both distinct from the void, whereas here I had equated them, this one. And then my task is to symbolize another way of representing a return to the void using these marks. And what comes out of that attempt is conjoining these two together and equating this expression with the void, so that this expression now symbolizes the absence of objects. And then I can break that return and use another expression, and they get more and more complex, and it unfolds into all sorts of multiplicity and levels of duality upon duality, and it splinters off into all sorts of numbers. What's kind of a neat trick about this that I sort of stumbled upon was that the value after this third one, the fourth one that you get, come on, pen. Involves four crosses expressed like this. And we have four levels now at this stage, and if we look at the expressions of value at each level, we have the single cross, and then the cross negated, and then the cross with the cross negated, And then the cross with the cross negated, and all that negated, or crossed. And if any of you are familiar with Nagarjuna, you might remember his four-cornered argument, which is that, well, it's... you could say that it's... the void is not an object, and it's not not the object, and it's not both the object and not the object, and it's not not both the object and not the object. And this sort of falls out of this kind of magically for some reason. And so you have this, out of this idea of distinction, we get this pattern of many flowing out of the one. And the sort of mechanism of this is this back and forth kind of yin-yang process of breaking this self-referential reentry and then recreating it on another level. And then breaking that and then recreating it, returning. And then breaking that return and then returning. And out of that unfolds all these different levels. And any expression, if you remember this expression I had earlier, reduced to one of the two states. Well, if we look at an expression in terms of all these different levels now, we see that we can interpret any expression of these distinctions at any given level we like, depending on what stage of multiplicity we want to fix ourselves at. If we fix ourselves at a level where there are four distinct values, then any expression will reduce to one of these four values. If we choose to represent it, to fix ourselves on the level of two values, then just as we saw earlier, the expression will reduce to one of the two values. The same expression. On the other hand, we can choose also to go all the way back to the point where the distinction was equal to, where the object is equal to the absence of object, where it didn't make any difference at all. And at that level, any expression simply is the void. It's expressing none other than that. There's no duality, there's no difference in states or anything. And so it's all a matter of which level we choose to view any form at. Now, this idea of re-entry, where we made the equation between the object and the absence of object, is very closely related in science to the idea of symmetry. If you consider a human body, it's roughly symmetrical down the center. And if you switch sides, then the right and the left are interchanged. And something is symmetrical if under this transformation, under this change, there's a kind of equality that's present. And so on the one hand, you're distinguishing two sides, and on the other hand, you're equating them to each other. So in a more abstract or pure example, if you consider a mathematical figure like a rectangle and consider one axis down the center, you can flip it and it appears exactly the same if you flip it down that axis, like this chalkboard. If you just draw a line here and flip the chalkboard, the rectangular shape will remain invariant under that change. And so we're equating these two different states. And so there's a kind of unity beneath this difference that we've created. And this equation between the object and the absence of object is the very same idea, that we've, on the one hand, we've left the object, but on the other hand, we return right to where we left. We depart from the void, imagine an object, but the object is the void. And so the distinction between the object and the absence of object is only imagined. And so there's a natural return there. And so there's an equality between what is imagined to be different. And this idea of symmetry is very important in modern science. And the idea of an invariant within change, of a unity within difference, of a constancy throughout transitions. The very idea of substance is an invariant throughout all change. And in science, in physics, we've had different levels of substance. For a long time, it was thought that the invariant was the atom. But the atoms were indestructible. That's what it means in Greek. It says you cannot divide it. And so this was the invariant substance. Throughout all transformations of matter in the world, the atom was left unchanged. Until later on, it discovered, well, you can knock the electrons off and things, and they found out that the atom was in fact decomposable into more fundamental substances. And these elementary particles were now seen as the invariant under all changes. You could take them apart and recombine them and in all these atomic reactions and nuclear reactions. You could transform one element into another. And so the invariant then was at a different level. And now even matter is equated with energy, and so there's a more fundamental substance yet that's a kind of amalgamation of both matter and energy, that now they can be transformed into each other, and that's the more fundamental substance or invariant under all the changes. And the material particles are simply manifestation states of that more fundamental substance. And so there are these strata of substance, just as we had here sort of the strata of forms, of levels of interpreting things. You can reduce things to one level, and things can be relatively invariant on that level, or you can reduce them further and further and further, till ultimately you ought to be able to reduce it to the point where there are no distinctions at all. In the physical laws, we also have this sort of pattern where you'll have a very general law, like Einstein's equations of gravity. And these are extremely comprehensive and general laws that hold in all sorts of circumstances and are much more universal than, say, Newton's laws of gravity, which apply under more restricted circumstances. And then even in applying Newton's laws, we derive even more restricted forms of laws that are even less universal. So for example, if I apply Newton's law to a small area on the Earth, then I'll get a gravitational field that's relatively uniform, and objects will travel in parabolas, like a projectile when you throw it. On the other hand, if you look on the scale of planets, Newton's law will tell you that things move in ellipses. And so that the same law will reduce in different circumstances to different types of behavior, of ways of governing matter. And this is a kind of symmetry breaking that on the most general level, the law is the most invariant to all circumstances. It's the most general and universal law. Whereas the particular manifestation of that law, say on the surface of the earth, isn't as invariant. The law you derive with the particular law for the projectile on earth, it won't apply on Jupiter, it won't apply in the middle of space. Whereas Einstein's general equations of relativity apply everywhere. And so there's this similar sort of pattern of generality breaking down into more and more diversified expressions of truth that are more contingent. And this is kind of an image of what's happening here in a very abstract way of this breaking of reentry, of creating multiplicity out of a unity. That's how some of these ideas might fit into science in kind of a general way. A more particular way would take a lot more mathematics to explain. As far as relating to some religious ideas, I thought I'd give just a couple quick examples. One is that fits this very well is the view of Kashmir Shaivism. Is that the right pronunciation? Yeah. Shaivism. Yeah. Which describes the original, the void, as Parama Shiva, and the original act of creation is just this act of a distinguishing between the pure light of consciousness and the sort of the most refined of all objects, the negation of the potential universe, I think it's called. And so we just begin to have this hint of a distinction between subject and object. And then as it proceeds to the next level, there's a sort of a favoring of the subjective side, and it's symbolized as I am that, with the emphasis on the I, where there's more awareness or presence in the subject rather than the object. And then on the next stage, the polarity sort of reverses to the state where that I am, the emphasis being on the object. And then it equalizes to where there's a balance between the two, where there's this unity and diversity. And this is the state where there's a distinction, but there's no confusion about the fact that it's only imagined, that in fact both sides are manifestations of Parama Shiva, of the one, the original. And this is almost a complete parallel of what happens in this description of the first stage, where the mark is equal to the absence of the mark, where there's this reentry. And then from that stage, the description breaks off into illusion in that philosophy, which corresponds here to the break into duality, into the two-state system. So there's a very beautiful correspondence there between this sort of abstract scheme and that description of the creation of the world. I a couple connections with Dr. Wolf's aphorisms, for example. This already came out a lot, is that the mark can be seen as the object, the universe, the absence of the mark as the absence of objects, of nirvana. And when he says in the aphorisms that, well, to consciousness without an object, the universe and nirvana are the same. And that's exactly what that equation in the beginning said, so that the mark is equal to the absence of the mark. That's the re-entry. And the re-entry is also a beautiful image of this light of consciousness turning back on itself, of this going out but returning. And that when we broke off into duality, we saw that it went off, but it didn't return. It got stuck there. And so there wasn't this natural return. It got stuck out in the object, and then we had to sort of artificially bring it back. So that's a sort of abstract mathematical representation of a couple of Dr. Wolf's ideas. These mathematical symbols are by no means any sort of theory or anything at this stage. It's very sort of symbolic and metaphorical, and but there are some more solid connections being made. But at this point, it's very much in the stage of being born, I think. But it's my hope that something along these lines can serve as a way to sort of integrate scientific views and religious views into some sort of coherent picture through this abstract framework. And I think it'll take something very abstract like this, because only these very abstract symbols have this power of being so general. That's the price of abstraction, or the value of it. And hopefully some of the tensions that are created because of apparent differences between worldviews, between religions, and between science and religion can be dissipated when some sort of connection like this is made between them. And also, and they help to connect each one back with its own source.
Physicist on TV for 3 weeks talking about the gravitational force and all the things. He's talking about the four fundamental forces. And he was saying that scientists are just now maybe coming around to the point of communicating the notion that possibly all these different forces are a manifestation of one single force. He said that on TV.
Yeah, that's the holy grail of physics.
Yeah. And to me, the scientific revolution is going to happen in different ways, and the different ways to make it more accessible to different people. And it's really beautiful. It's great. The boy. There's no way I can understand what you think.
Thank you.
Where did you have?
Yeah.